welcome to this episode of the Essential Church Podcast, an ongoing conversation about some of the most important issues facing the local church today. I'm your host, Andrew Arndt, and I'm joined today by Amy Julia Becker. Amy Julia is a wife, mother of three, and a truly prolific author. She's written essays that have appeared in the Washington Post, USA Today, Christianity Today, Christian Century, and online for places like the New York Times, ABC News, The Atlantic, among many others. And she's also the author of several books, including the one that we're going to talk about with her today, White Picket Fences, Turning Toward Love in a World Divided by Privilege. We're excited to have you here today. So welcome, Amy Julia.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here too.
Yeah. Well, so tell us, you know, a lot of our readers, our listeners are not going to be super aware of who you are. So maybe give us some context for who you are, a little bit about your family, and then we'll get into talking about your book today.
Sure. Yeah. So I live in Connecticut and with my three kids who are now 13, 10, and 8. And our oldest daughter, Penny, has Down syndrome. I also have a English literature degree undergrad, but then went to seminary. So I have a master's of divinity as well. So I've tended to do a lot of writing about faith and family and disability over the years, as well as a fair amount of speaking and teaching on, you know, those intersecting topics. But I also do a lot of spending time, you know, shuttling children to ballet and soccer and, you know, so forth and so on. So yeah, my life consists of a lot of thinking and reading and writing and being with our kids.
That's wonderful. Well, 15 years ago, when you were going through college and graduate school and all that and starting to make plans for your career, you probably, as I gathered reading your book, you probably did not plan to write this book. So tell us a little bit. I want to hear the story of the book, White Picket Fences. Tell us a bit about it and why you chose to write it. Or maybe I'll even flip the question around, because sometimes a topic we don't choose, it kind of chooses us in some ways. So tell us about that.
Oh my gosh. I definitely accidentally backed my way into this book and did not mean to get here. I'm really grateful that ultimately I landed here. But I was, I'd written a book about our daughter Penny called A Good and Perfect Gift back in 2011, which was a memoir about what it took for me to receive her as a gift. Then I wrote a book called Small Talk, which is a parenting memoir about the ways in which having small children reshaped and reformed my faith and my sense of self, and, you know, hopefully offering some kind of hope and encouragement for other parents. And after that, I was planning on writing a book about children's literature. So the experience of reading out loud books with our kids. And I love that experience. Again, I'm a big reader and writer. And I wrote a good like 80 to 100 pages of that book. So I was like a year into it. I was researching E.B. White and Beverly Cleary and all these classic children's books authors. But as I was writing some of these chapters, there were a couple things that came up. One was I was just thinking about the opportunities I had to read with my kids, both in terms of my like facility with language and with literature, access to books, time in the evening on a regular basis. So I was thinking about some of the things that set me apart from other parents that were not other parents' fault, that just were by happenstance of my birth or my education and access to education.
Yes.
Then I also, around the time our kids were transitioning from like picture books to children's like chapter books, I noticed what I had done was I had chosen all books that had been read to me as a child.
Right.
And because I loved them. I knew they'd stood the test of time. They were great works of children's literature. And I started to notice that they were all mirrors. So they were white suburban families, who had nice lives and similar problems to ours. And they were not doors. They were not opening experiences for my kids to think about other people, other times, other places, and other experiences in the world. And particularly, I recognized we didn't have books about people of color. And so that set me on a whole journey to find those books, to recognize that a lot of those books had not been written historically. They hadn't been a place for them in the publishing industry, which then led to this whole set of questions for me about my own childhood. Yeah. I grew up in a small town in North Carolina, even though my family is from Connecticut. And I had always thought about issues relating to race and class and justice. But going back to my childhood through the lens of children's literature and the books I was reading to my kids, I ultimately got to this place where I was asking questions that were bigger than questions about the books on the bookshelf. Mm-hmm. And I found myself wanting, just writing a lot about my own childhood, actually. Mm-hmm. And eventually I said, oh my gosh, I'm not writing a book about children's literature. I'm writing a book about privilege and about what it means to be a person who was born into relative affluence, yep, access to opportunity and education, and whiteness. And what does that mean? And how mm-hmm. do I reckon with it?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I loved about reading your book and what was refreshing about it is I think we're hearing more and more about privilege and issues of race and class and socioeconomic status. And the whole, it can be very polarizing. It's a very energized and it can be energizing. It can also be scary and fraught. And one of the things that I thought was refreshing about your book was your honesty about your own fear even heading into the conversation. I mean, you talk about a little twitch that you developed.
Yes.
Tell our listeners a little bit about that and kind of what this conversation brings up for you.
Yes. So I noticed that I had developed an eye twitch. And at first I thought it's just from like spending too much time at the computer. But I was like, oh, but it's happening at sometimes when I'm not at the computer. And yeah, other times when I'm at the computer, it's not happening. And I finally was like, oh my gosh, it's only happening if I'm thinking about or working on this book. And so I mentioned this to a friend and they said, I think you're flinching. Like, I think you're anticipating what is going to happen when you try to talk as a wealthy white woman about issues related to race and class and disability and social division. Yeah. And so I thought, oh, that is absolutely right. And which was really a great invitation to recognize what is going on inside me? How can I actually pray about these fears and acknowledge them to God and ask for protection and for provision in walking out into the world and talking about these things? And really what I ultimately found was there are a lot of people who are in that place, just like I was, of feeling like I desperately want to try to think about some of these issues, but I'm so afraid I'm going to say the wrong thing. I don't have all the knowledge. I certainly don't have all the experience. How do I do that? And so starting to have some of those conversations actually helped my eyes calm down.
that's awesome. Well, good for you. I'm glad to hear that. I think that most people are kind of in that place where there's a bit of a flinch when they think about this conversation because they're afraid. They're afraid of, like you said, saying the wrong thing or betraying their ignorance in some way. So a lot of people they kind of tense up and they stay out of it rather than leaning into it. But I want to ask you, as you've learned to lean into the conversation about privilege, how has learning to see the world through the lens of privilege reshaped how you see your past and how you also see the world that you live in right now? How has it complexified it for you? Talk to us about that for a minute.
Yeah, so I think especially because I grew up in a small southern town, which really was functionally segregated still in the late 70s and early 80s, and it's a different town now than it was then. But when I was growing up, reckoning with issues of race was very prominent in looking back at that town. And I had grown up, I mean, again, my image of my childhood was it was a idyllic, bucolic childhood. Yeah. I loved my school. I loved my neighbors. It was safe. It was fun. I learned and grew. And that's all I saw. And so then it was somewhat horrifying to look back and say, and I went to a school that literally was founded because of desegregation. It was a private school that was founded. And I learned there was a whole history of private schools across the nation, especially throughout the South, that had been founded on those premises. And I thought, gosh, you're right. My school was all white. I didn't even think about that as a kid. Yeah. So that's one thing. And secondly, and I loved it. I learned a lot there. So what do I do with these really conflicting emotions of recognizing that there was injustice in this place that I absolutely loved? And so, that complicated, my understanding of not just my childhood and my family, but really my like history as a white American who can be both so grateful and proud of this idea of like liberty and justice for all that we hold, and yet also recognizing, and we haven't lived that out anything close to, you know, reasonable justice in a lot of our history. And so trying to hold grief and gratitude together instead of thinking it has to be an either or was really where I ended up landing. And that's still true for me in my life as I continue to, you know, live in a country that is divided along a lot of social lines And I often feel pretty powerless to do anything about that. And sometimes I just feel lazy about doing things about that and, you know, just don't do anything. So it was helpful for me to do that work of looking back at my childhood, of feeling some real grief, but also holding on to, but there were things that were good here.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say that they weren't. I'm just going to try to hold them in tension.
Well, that's one of the things that you do a really nice job of, is you tell the story of your upbringing, and here you're growing up in the South that has this history of immense racial tension. There were what you call the banal evils of some of the things that were just built into the culture that everybody just accepted.
Yeah.
Including your own family accepted some of those things. And yet your parents, in ways that you point out, had ways of resisting that culture that you weren't able to see until many years later. So you're looking back over your childhood and you're seeing that it's not just, you can't paint it with one color.
Right.
But you talk about grief and gratitude. And do you find that most people feel like when they start kind of coming awake to this conversation that they feel like they have to choose between one or the other?
Well, I know I felt that way for a long time. And I do think that is part of the fear. And I have had actually people talk to me about saying, I feel like I'm either going to reject, younger people, maybe in their 30s, I'm either going to reject my parents and my childhood and delve into some of the social justice questions that we are really facing as a nation in a more obvious everyday way than we did in the past, or I'm just going to kind of toe the party line, be grateful for what I've been given in terms of my faith community, in terms of my school, in terms of my parents, and I'm going to ignore all of that stuff.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of us are feeling like we're at a bit of a breaking point and we need to actually figure out how to navigate this.
Boat. Well, tell us on that, then tell us why is it so important that if we do come from a place of privilege, and really privilege even of itself is not a monolithic idea, is it? There are many different kinds of privilege, and which you do a nice job of exploring in the book. But I want to just ask this question. Why is it important that we not demonize privilege? So if we came from a place that's privileged, why is it important that we not demonize it?
Yeah, great question. I think there are a couple different reasons. One is that there is a sense of we are all born into a social location, right? And as especially as Christians, to ask, what is God doing in me and through me in this place? And so I remember speaking to a group in Raleigh, North Carolina. I was speaking alongside another man who had also grown up in Eastern North Carolina, but was a Black man. So we had had very different experiences, but we were both people of faith. And a white man in the audience said, I sometimes feel like I should put a paper bag on my head when I walk out the door. Oof. Like, it is so hard to know what I represent in this city as a white man. And the man I was speaking with, again, who was an African American, said, God made you who you are too. And you need to figure out what it means to live into that, right? And so essentially to live as a steward of the privilege you've been given. And sometimes that's going to mean resisting it when you can see very obvious aspects of injustice. But other times it's going to mean saying, I recognize that I might have power and access that other people don't have. And how can I use that not for myself alone, but in a way that actually is a blessing? Because that's, I think, what God is always wanting to do with us, is to bless us that we might be a blessing to other people. And obviously not doing that in a way that becomes like patriarchal.
That's right. Or paternalistic.
Right. Or paternalistic. Yeah. So there's a tricky line there in terms of the humility of holding that as something, this is not just given to me. This is given to me that I might be giving it away, that I might be sharing, that I might be stewarding, stewarding that.
And I mean, I want you to talk to us a bit about your notion of the insidious irony of privilege.
Yeah.
Because sometimes when we start coming alive to this conversation, we go, oh, I have so many resources and I was born into privilege. And so I need to be able to give that away and help other people. It becomes asymmetrical. So it's patriarchal or paternalistic. And so it's us who have helping those who don't have. But you talk about this insidious irony that when we come from privilege, in some ways that can actually isolate us from the very things that make us human. So in some ways, the privilege is a form of poverty. And I don't say that lightly, but it's true that it can become a form of poverty. So talk to us about that for a minute.
Yeah. So I think when, and for me, having a child with a disability is where a lot of this I had already been thinking a lot about race and class, but especially when I had a child with a disability who was both born into the privilege of a white, educated, affluent family, and on the outside of that, in terms of a history of discrimination and laws, as well as systems that had excluded people with Down syndrome for all, you know, many, many years, I started to think a little bit differently. And at first, what I thought is, I need to work for justice, right? Yeah, I need to get people like my daughter to be included and to have what I have.
Right.
And it's easy to extend that thinking to other people who are kind of outside of the center, who are marginalized, and think, yes, I need to work for justice for people of color, people in poverty, people, da, da. But what also happened over the course, and that's all, I think, good and right.
Yes, it's true.
But can set up a bad dynamic. So what also happened in me, though, was that as Penny grew up and I got to know her and I read Theology of Disability books and I met other people with Down syndrome, what I started to see was, to use your word, like my own impoverishment. Like I, as someone who has always so highly valued the intellect, getting to know people with intellectual disabilities, I started to see what I needed.
Right.
Not just what I could give, but the ways in which I didn't understand love. The ways in which I didn't understand human relationships as being more valuable than human productivity.
Yeah.
The ways in which I was hyper-individualistic instead of understanding community. Mm. So I started to recognize this dynamic that it wasn't just that Penny and people on the margins needed me.
Yeah.
It was that I also desperately needed them. And that they had much, much, much to give. And so that helped me to understand that the way we construct privilege, the social advantages that we give as a culture to some people and not to others, distorts our humanity and therefore harms everyone. So it harms, yes, all the people who are marginalized and shut out, but it also harms those on the inside in terms of that isolation, in terms of that like uber achievement oriented culture that can idolize money, success, perfection, you know, a whole host of things. And we see it in the data that people who are wealthy, educated, white, you put those groups together and it's like high rates of depression, anxiety, and substance abuse.
Right, exactly.
Is this what we're going for, really?
Yeah.
So there's harm all around because of these social divisions. And so that's where privilege is an insidious irony. And especially, I think, for people of faith, there are opportunities to enter in with a word of healing.
Yes.
And with actions that can lead towards healing, participating in God's work of healing in our culture.
Well, I got a couple more questions. That's so good. I got a couple more questions for you. I want to read a section of your book towards the end here, and then that'll get us into the last few minutes of our interview. But you say, this is in one of your final chapters called A Reversal. You say on page 189 that I now understand two things about privilege that I didn't understand before. One, that privilege in and of itself is not a sign of God's blessing, but rather a fact of my life that can be used for good or for ill. So that's the first thing. And then secondly, you say that what our culture calls privilege is a mirage, a false understanding of what it means to live a good life, and that the true privilege of my existence comes in the undeserved favor I have in being one who is loved by God, loved by others, and able to love in return. And what was surprising to me when I read your book is that I was waiting for you to give us some prescription. So this is what we need to go and do to fix the world and to tear down privilege or to fix ourselves. But there's a humility about what you're advocating for here. So you're not telling us to go out and fix the world per se, nor are you telling us to demonize our privilege. Instead, it seems that you're advocating for something else. If you could fill in that blank, what is the something else that you're advocating for? What are you trying to push us towards in this book? What would that be?
Yeah, so I mean, I do very intentionally end the book with a question. And so there is a sense of engaging, I hope, readers in self-examination and conversation of like, do I actually want things to change? Will I recognize the harm, not just to other people, but in myself? And how do I, you know, how do I respond to that? But I have, as I've been speaking about the book in the past 6 months, kind of recognize that what I am hopeful for is a holistic response to the harm of privilege. And the way I talk about it is head, heart, and hands. So we do some kind of intellectual work of thinking about our history, our current reality, learning about the demographics of a city in which I live, or the different, you know, who is in poverty and why, just asking some of those just basic questions. And then engaging our hearts, which I see as both a spiritual practices of prayer that I hadn't learned before, like lament, understanding what it means to confess, understanding what it means to wait for God when things don't seem to be changing quickly, and then joining with other Christians in prayer as well about these things, and having friendships that extend beyond our natural social lines and boundaries, having mentors that extend outside of that. And then after there's been some of that head and heart work, then to say, okay, in community with other people, especially people who are outside of my own social group, and before God, what do I do? What do I do to have my small part in God's healing work in the world, which I think can be as small as I'm going to change the books on my bookshelf to as big as I'm going to run for city council, or I'm going to petition the state legislature for education reform. Or, I mean, there's a huge range of possibilities, which can in and of itself be overwhelming. Yeah. But I think that sustained, lifelong, humble, loving action needs to come out of both some head and heart work if we're going to, again, remain humble, actually be listening to other people, and be understanding that, yeah, I'm not going to fix all the problems. That's not my job. Rather, my job is to say, where is God in the work of healing, and how can I be a part of it? And what's my piece? What's my little piece in this?
That's so good. Give us some practicals. What are some things that have changed in your life and your family's life as you begin to really lean into this conversation?
Yeah. So on that very intimate scale, I mean, the bookshelf has changed. When we think about going on family vacations, we have been more intentional about, you know, we went to Washington, D.C., and we went to the Museum of African American History. And we've done we've had conversations with our kids that I'm not sure 10 years ago we would have had, even at the same ages, in terms of American history and letting it be complex. So there's been that kind of intimate level. But there's also been, like, I am more aware when I go to a church that is predominantly white, and yet, what does it mean for us as a congregation to engage with our brothers and sisters in faith who are people of color? And so talking with our pastor, who is like-minded, and so we've started having pastors who are people of color intentionally come in and guest preach and talk about what it means for us to be brothers and sisters in Christ. So they're small things, but they're, I think, meaningful at the same time. And then and then there's a level of friendship and mentorship of just reaching out to my friend Patricia Raybon, who actually lives in Denver, is an older African-American Christian woman who wrote the foreword to this book and has been just truly a mentor to me in a safe place to ask some of my ignorant questions, and a friend who's been willing to be gentle and faithful and gracious to me as I've tried to learn and understand more. So those are some of the ways that things have changed for me. And then there's a whole institutional level, again, of just what does it mean to participate politically? What does it mean to think about systems of reform?
Well, once you start thinking and praying in this direction, you'll start seeing the world differently, and then you'll start seeing the opportunities. You can kind of let it unfold pretty organically, I suppose.
I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah, that the Lord has a way of bringing opportunities to you that'll help you grow in what he's teaching you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Essential Church Podcast. Our goal is always to strengthen and provoke the thinking of church and ministry leaders. And so if you found this or any episode helpful to you, please go to iTunes and leave us a review. Your reviews help leaders just like you find our podcast. And if you have any comments or suggestions on people or topics you'd like for us to cover, be sure to let us know via social media. And of course, please do share this and other episodes you find helpful around the web. Grace, mercy, and peace be with you.